We're excited to have Dr. Stephen Ditchkoff with us today. He is a professor of wildlife ecology and management at Auburn University. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Well, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Tell us about the facility and what you study there.
Well, in 2007, we developed a deer research facility that was designed to really allow us to give us the best of both worlds with regards to deer research. Deer research has traditionally been done in two venues where either little 1 and 2 acre pens that have given you a lot of control over your study animals, or with free range animals where you get realistic behavior but you don't have much control. This facility was designed to kind of simulate both of those. So we have a 430 acre facility where we have intimate knowledge of all the deer in our facility, but they're able to exhibit kind of natural behavior. And it gives us the opportunity to answer questions that you just can't answer in any other scenario.
Wow. Is there any way the public can take tours up there?
Unfortunately, we don't do that.
Okay.
While we would love to be able to just, you know, allow people to see it and take people out there, we just don't have the personnel or the resources to be able to accommodate that.
Right. I understand. Well, you know, Dr. Stephen, around this time of year, we always get a proposal about legalizing baiting in Alabama. In your opinion, what are the implications of baiting being legalized, and how does it influence deer movement? How does supplemental feeding or baiting affect predator successes? Talk about that a little bit.
Baiting's always a pretty controversial topic. You know, there's some states that where it's legal to harvest deer over bait, and there's other states where it's not legal.
Right.
I personally don't have an opinion on it one way or another. I think it's a dead deer whether you shoot it over bait or not.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, it creates some real touchy issues with, you know, some people from an oral, moral or ethical perspective.
Right.
I think that's what it is. I think it's a moral or ethical argument. A lot of people try and turn it into a biological argument. There's the argument that says that they'll be able to kill more deer over bait, or there's the argument that, you know, in opposition, they say it's going to spread disease. I think those are both pretty shallow arguments here in Alabama. I still think it's a moral or ethical argument.
Okay. So it doesn't really have a lot of influence on the deer biology, the movement of deer, or does supplemental feeding and baiting affect predator success?
I think it affects hunter success.
Yeah.
I think hunters think it's going to help them, but the best data that are available out there actually shows that hunter success eventually goes down when you legalize baiting. You get the impression that you're seeing more deer, but the reality is when you have a bait site, you have a tendency to continue to go to that same site again and again and again.
Yeah.
And those deer learn your patterns, and they just wait until after dark to come out. You're going to see fawns and yearlings, which is not what you're trying to shoot in the first place.
Well, I think you're exactly right on that. I have a farm in southwest Kentucky, and we see the exact same thing. You can bait on the farm, and we'll keep food on it, corn on it for trail camera surveys. But other than that, I mean, I've killed, I think, three or four deer off that farm this year. Not one of them has been over corn. And it's just because, like you said, the deer pattern you just as much as you pattern them to those concentrated food sources. And more than anything, we do get, I would say, 90% of our coyote pictures come from bait sites where it's concentrating the majority of the does and the fawns. And I really think it, as far as the predators go, I think it concentrates the deer more. Whether the predators have more success, I don't really know how that would affect it, or I don't have any proof that it does. But it definitely isn't going to help the hunter the way they think it will.
I don't think it does. I think it's kind of one of these, you know, magical bullets that hunters think it's going to help them. They see it on TV. They see hunters in Texas doing it on television, and they say, "Wow, that's great." And, you know, sometimes you'll be very fortunate and you'll get a good deer, and other times you'll spend a lot of time staring at the same 3 or 4 deer day after day after day.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, eventually your hunting skill just goes down.
Yeah.
And I think the part that I find sad about it is we see this proposed in the legislature every year, and while I understand our state legislators, you know, work for the people, gosh, I'd rather them spend their time working on things like, you know, taxes and health care, you know, support for education, some items I think are a little more important than how someone shoots a deer.
Doctor, I understand that some of your graduate students have been conducting radio-collared deer studies sponsored by the Alabama Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. Can you share with us how those studies are being conducted and where?
Yeah, we just completed these studies in, I think we wrapped them up in the fall of 2016. And Division of Wildlife Freshwater Fisheries, decided they, you know, felt that they needed a little more information with regards to survival rates of deer and movement patterns of deer to be able to develop better management plans for the deer hunter in Alabama, the deer population in Alabama. And so we put out approximately 80 to 90 radio collars on deer. Some of these were GPS collars that enabled us to get locations every hour for approximately 18 months, and then there were a number that were VHF collars that gave us survival, a lot of information on survival rates and mortality patterns. And, you know, generally speaking, there were not any major surprises, except for the standpoint that we had anticipated that, I had personally anticipated that deer survival in public areas would be lower than what we find on private properties, when in reality it was very comparable, which I was, you know, very pleased with. You know, what that tells me is they have a pretty good management scheme going in the state of Alabama on their wildlife management areas, and those are real good places for the public to hunt.
Good deal. What is the buck's average, without being in rut, what is his average home range?
Normally, you know, prior to the breeding season, you're looking at, you know, in the summer, down to about 200 acres. You know, and it can range up to about 600 acres. You know, during the breeding season, can go maybe as high as 1,200 acres.
And when they're in rut, how much does that range expand, if any?
The range probably doesn't expand too much, but it's going to vary depending on, you're going to find some individuals that are going to make what we call extra home range movements, or they're going to make excursive behaviors. Where you might find individuals that go on some sort of excursion during a 24-hour period looking for some sort of resource. So during the rut, you might have, you know, bucks that are saying, wow, I need to find some does right now, and they're kind of going out exploring, which is kind of neat for the hunter that, you know, during the breeding season, particularly during the peak or just or the post-breeding season, a lot of these bucks are out wandering into new areas, and even though you haven't seen a deer on trail cams, there's a good possibility always that new deer are moving through your property all the time, and maybe that's the opportunity to get that big one that you never saw on camera.
And on that same subject, too, as far as their home range, as far as, I guess you could say, the area that they would call home, how much shift did you see between summer and fall home ranges? I know, in my experience, only about 50% of our deer actually shift their summer range and their fall range. I would say 50% of them, you know, live in the same area.
Yeah, we didn't really look at home range shifts in this study, but in some previous work that we've done, you know, we found that, you know, while most deer tend to utilize the same, at least in that study population in Oklahoma, most deer tended to utilize that same range from summer to fall. There were some deer that would winter and summer 5 miles apart, and it was just amazing to see. And then some other individuals would, you know, spend the rut in a completely different section or 640 acres from one year to the next, even to the third year.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, I think it comes down a lot to, you know, as you said, the majority of the deer, their home range was, you know, X size. I've seen individual deer that, I have one buck in particular on a farm I hunt that, in my opinion, that deer doesn't leave. I never go a day without getting pictures of him on every camera. I think individual deer, you know, I think it varies a lot too from deer to deer.
I think you're exactly right. They all have extremely unique personalities, and they behave entirely different. And, you know, I've learned that if you go out there with a certain picture in mind of what a deer is going to do, that may be true for 10% of the deer out there, but the other 90% are going to be doing something completely different.
I imagine that it could depend on the food sources somewhat. In certain areas, like if you have big agricultural fields with soybeans and providing plenty of protein for deer during the summer, they may change areas in the winter to look for maybe fresh acorns or something.
Oh, there's no question. You know, depending upon what the habitat composition is in your area, depending upon what the patterns of hunting pressure are, even probably traffic patterns in the area. You know, deer generally don't cross interstates too often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of those things could influence, you know, the how deer are moving from season to season.
Well, it's certainly human activity can change a deer's habit. Do you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. You know,
yeah, we tend to visit our cameras too often right before deer season, and then we wonder what happened to those big bucks. Sometimes you think maybe they know when the season comes in. A special guest today, Dr. Stephen Ditchkoff, And also, Daryl Bell is sitting in for Joe today. Joe has had a brand new baby boy, and we wish him the best of luck with that. Congratulations. Dr. Stephen Dishkov, we've talked a lot about several subjects, and Daryl is an avid deer hunter, more so than I. But I have a question about your findings. You've talked about your radio collar deer, and you've been doing studies on deer for a long time. What are some of the most interesting findings that have come out of this study?
I guess over the years, some of the most interesting stuff, and that we found here recently with some of the work we've done here in Alabama, are the impacts that hunting pressure has on deer movements. You kind of referred to them a little bit before the break there, that deer kind of seem to know what you're doing before you do, and we found that deer movements on weekends, deer movements are fairly active during the day on Thursdays, and on Fridays it's real high. It begins to decline on Saturday, and by Sunday and Monday, deer movement during the day is very low.
How about that?
It really doesn't recover until about Wednesday or Thursday. They have you patterned. If I was going to go just pick a random day to go hunting, Wednesday and Thursday are the best, just based upon what we see as far as deer movements.
That's pretty interesting there. We do tend to move around in the woods too much, I think, just prior to deer season especially. And that, these deer have developed skills and senses that their lives depend on. And so we don't really know to what extent they have those senses, although it's amazing what we've learned so far.
And there's no question. I hear a lot of people that worry about, try and reduce the number of times you pull the trigger on your food plots and that sort of thing. And I really don't think it's gunshots that are spooking deer. I think you need to consider the fact that every time you walk to your stand and back, you leave a trail of odor. And I don't know if that odor's there for 3 hours, 6 hours, or 24 hours. But, these deer are pretty good at what they do. And every time they cross your trail, they're detecting a human presence. And if they're detecting that regularly, then they figure out pretty quick that the season's on.
In our magazine each month, and our readers swear by it, we have a moon time chart. And based upon what position the moon is, how close it is to the Earth, and several other factors, you can sort of predict when deer or animals or birds feed, fish bite. Have you done any studies on the effect of moon times on deer movement?
We have. We really didn't look at movements, but we looked at activity. Was a deer up and moving?
Okay.
And, we wanted to examine if there was any validity to solunar charts, because we knew that solunar charts were developed back in the 1940s, and they were developed with fisheries data. And, we know that there's something causing, at certain time periods, it seems like every deer in the woods is up and moving during the middle of the day. And it's not like there was a memo passed around. So there's something triggering that, and so we decided to take a look and see if these solunar charts actually predicted deer activity. And what we found is that there is something to these charts. However, the periods, what they call periods of major activity, were actually poor periods to hunt, and what they called periods of minor activity were the best times to hunt.
How about that?
It was really interesting that there's something to it based upon the fisheries data, but it hasn't quite been worked out exactly yet. And so I think we're onto something here, and hopefully here in a couple of years we'll be able to shed a little more light on, better times to hunt as opposed to times that may not be as successful.
Yeah, and we talked about that a little earlier. The moon is definitely a factor we look at, or I look at when I determine when I think the deer are going to move. But I look at a lot of other factors, honestly, before the moon, as far as barometric pressure and temperature change and wind change. Was there anything with the pressure, with those majors and minors, in conjunction with the moon that you think affected, the validity of those charts?
We haven't looked at any of those abiotic factors other than solunar patterns at this time. But I do have a graduate student that is looking at that. That is what his thesis research is on. And so we're examining some past data right now to take a look at barometric pressure and wind direction and temperature and all of those factors to see how they influence deer movement. How do those factors change, whether it's the breeding, the rut, the pre-rut, the post-rut, et cetera, et cetera. But also, then how do they influence, work with solunar patterns.
Right. Yeah. And I kind of have a checklist when I'm looking at it. And as long as I can get a couple of those, you know, there together, I feel like I've been pretty successful, and it's proven true, you know, whether it's, you know, in conjunction with a moon and a pressure change, you know, the moon being in the right spot and the pressure, you know, in conjunction with when the deer should move based on that moon, or whether it's a drop in wind speed or a drop in temperature. Like you said, I don't think the moon alone influences it the way that people think it does. A lot of other factors go into it, you know, and what those factors are varies pretty often.
Well, it's a complex scenario.
It is.
You know, most folks like me have always hunted whenever they had time to hunt, and not lucky enough to go by moon times and high pressure, low pressure, and all that. But sometimes I think we're doing more harm than good on going on a bad day. Dr. Stephen Ditchkoff, I sure appreciate you taking time to be with us today. It's been very interesting. I thank you so much, and I hope you have a great day.
Hey, I appreciate you having me. You guys have a great day as well.